Welcome to the Journalism Explainer, the podcast series that takes you behind the scenes of journalism's reinvention. I'm Julie Pizzetti in Sydney, and today we're deep diving into the vexed issue of news publishing business models. Google's global head of news, Richard Gingras, is the online pioneer who began Salon.com, which was the world's first online-only journalism publication. And he's been in the business of online publishing for 30 years. At Google, he oversees a range of initiatives that are designed to foster digital journalism innovation. His latest project is Accelerated Mobile Pages, known as the AMP Project. AMP is an open, collaborative news publishing project that aims to maximise user experience of online and mobile news content through coding that allows for quick and streamlined data loading. One of the potential benefits of the project, which launched in January, is as an offset for ad blocking, a consumer practice that cost news publishers nearly $3 billion US dollars in 2015 alone. Gingras spoke to me on stage at Digital Media Europe in Vienna, where he was on a mission to prove that Google's latest developments and initiatives are part of a genuine, mutually beneficial relationship with news publishers.
Richard, 200 million people are now engaged in the practice of ad blocking, according to research that was conducted by Adobe and PageFair in 2015. So what does that signal about audience behaviour among news consumers? And do you think that publishers are now paying adequate attention to the warning signs?
Yes, indeed. If they're not paying attention to the warning signs, then they might be unconscious. I don't mean to, just a joke, but if you look at the data, the ad blocking percentage in Germany is between 35 and 40%. I was in Paris earlier this week, it's at 30%. Worse, if you look at it demographically, if you look at that key advertising segment of, say, 20 to 35, it's something like 55%. Those are terrifying numbers. If we don't think we have a crisis on our hands, then we're not looking at the numbers in a correct way. And I think it's important to look at this not as, you know, obviously a lot of folks can say ad blockers are terrible, and in a sense they are. But we can choose to take two different approaches, and probably should take both. One is, how can you address ad blockers? But beware how you approach that, because one of the reasons why it's at 35 to 40% in Germany was there were very, very visible efforts to fight ad blockers legally, which simply served the purpose of promoting to Germany the existence and availability of ad blockers. That was kind of a dangerous play. To me, the real issue with ad blockers is to recognize it as a symptom of an advertising ecosystem that is not currently what it needs to be. And that deserves addressing. And frankly, that's one of the two things that the AMP project was very specifically focused on.
Okay, so we'll move to the AMP project in a second. But if we say we're in the phase of moving towards advertising 2.0, digital advertising 2.0, acknowledging all of those issues around audience behaviour, what do you think 2.0 should look like for a news publisher?
Well, I mean, again, I think we have to address some underlying issues. And at core is respecting the consumer in the first place. We've done in our work at Google in looking at the ad blocker situation, we've done a ton of research on, with consumers, like what kinds of, where are your concerns? And as you might imagine, it's not only the cumbersome or awkward experiences they confront when there's a pop-up here and a pop-up there and a roadblock there, and it's, in many cases, it's simply the number of ads. One of the things we saw in the data was that they simply don't trust sites that have too many ads on them. And that makes perfect sense. I think we all look at that. When we arrive on a site that's got 20, 30 ads on the page, we say, I'm not sure I want to be here. So I think these are addressable issues. And it's everything from the user experience. Creating ad experiences that are indeed compelling more than annoying, that are at least fast performing and seamless in the experience. I think we also all have to be careful at how we communicate about what data is absorbed and how it's used. Mm. And obviously, we know that very well at Google with our own data collection. Obviously, we collect a lot of data, but I think it's very, very important to communicate to the user how that data is being used. And it may very well be that we're taking data that's not necessary. Because that is indeed a problem. When you look at ad blockers, it's not just I don't like the ad experiences and I'd rather not be there. It's, I really don't want my every move tracked.
Yeah, a question of trust, mm-hmm. really.
Yes, exactly. It's a question of trust.
So let's move to AMP, which I guess we can summarize as a project that's designed to speed up mobile content display and to sort of improve that user experience, with what I understand to be a payoff in terms of algorithmic boost in search results. So you end up with potential of your content that's been amped being higher placed in Google search results or highlighted. Is that correct? Would you summarize it differently?
We want to be careful in how we talk about that. I mean, it, obviously speed is a signal. We have communicated that speed is a signal for the last few years. There are several hundred signals that we look at in search ranking, and speed is one of them. Clearly, it's not the dominant signal. Does AMP help in that regard? Without question. Are we today looking to move the ecosystem closer to AMP-like experiences? Without question. And I think it's in the interest of the user. It's in the interest of the publishing environment. It's in the interest of the advertising environment. It's in the interest, frankly, of the future health and viability of the web itself. So if we're not all, frankly, engaged in trying to find solutions to these problems, then things are going to get far worse before they get far better. And I don't want to sit here and suggest that AMP is the only solution. I think it's a very, very powerful solution. The fact that it's a collaborative effort that was put together by dozens of publishers and stakeholders in the ecosystem, the fact that it's an open source effort that is engaging thousands of developers and thousands of stakeholders in figuring out where we go forward, I think is hugely important. If anyone else has any particular unique and helpful technological approaches to how we solve the problem, then we would love to hear that as well. But AMP is, you know, I think is on the table today as probably the most viable approach we have. And, you know, and I want to also be clear here. Yes, the two things that the AMP project was looking to achieve was, how do we address the performance of the web? How do we address the ads ecosystem? But there was a very, very significant secondary effect here that all of us were concerned about, particularly all of us who not only love the web for the ecosystem it is, but recognize as publishers, recognize as Google, how valuable that ecosystem is how do we make sure that the web remains that healthy and compelling platform? I should say remains. It's not quite a compelling platform at the moment, relative to proprietary platforms. Mm. That was very much a key objective here. And I think all of us who believe in the web recognize that. You know, I was remembering earlier, we all might remember 20 years ago when we started playing around the web, the term was we surfed the web. Yeah. You know, now it's walking through 6-inch mud. It's not a surf, it's a slog. And frankly, I think we can do far better.
Okay, so why specifically target publishers? It's taken quite some time for Google to get to the point where you're seeking to collaborate with publishers directly. You've obviously spent time nurturing relationships with editors and with journalists in newsrooms, for example, on various projects. But why this form of collaboration?
Well, I think two things. One, I think Google, just speaking of our company, you know, in and of itself has matured. We're a deeply an engineering culture, and I think we have over the last several years understood that it's not only in our interest, but it's in the mutual best interest of the ecosystem that we engage with the community of publishers in a different way. And it's something that I have been very, very passionate about and continue to be passionate about simply because it is of mutual benefit. You know, as I sometimes point out, because I've been asked many times in talking about AMP, are you doing this just because you want to make friends with publishers?
or and, access our data, which is the other criticism.
Well, but AMP has nothing to do with accessing anyone's. It's there. It's the, you know, the one thing that you have to keep and remember about AMP. And that's why when some folks say it's Google's AMP project, it's not Google's AMP project. It's the open source project. Yes, we have obviously been key to getting it off the ground and helping it move forward, but it's not the Google AMP project. It's everyone's. So one was recognizing that there was mutual benefit in this. And the mutual benefit with, when folks say this is about making friends with publishers, my answer is simply this. Look, when you think about it, where publishers and Google have common cause is in the health of the web. We both depend upon it. Google, if there were not a rich ecosystem of knowledge on the web, how is Google Search a relevant product? Right, we have obviously significant ad platforms, which probably every publisher in this room uses to some extent. That is based on the health of the open web. For publishers, any publisher today who understands how this ecosystem works recognizes that having that open environment of the web is absolutely crucial to building audiences, to creating new products and finding audiences for those products. We need the web for that. We want the web for that. You know, if over time the internet evolved to be primarily about proprietary platforms,
Facebook,
that effort would be hugely more difficult and hugely more expensive. And I don't say this as any criticism of Facebook. I understand what they're trying to do. They're smart people. But it is a proprietary, in a sense, walled garden platform. And I understand that. But I also thoroughly believe that this ecosystem of the web has been so valuable to society in so many ways that we have to be very careful of thinking that somehow it'll just continue to be that way without ongoing assessments on the part of those who rely on it to make sure that it's evolving in a proper way.
Sure. I mean, there's probably no doubt in this room that's been a gift to freedom of expression and supports journalism in many ways. But let's look specifically at AMP and what you've learned so far through this project, through the collaborations that are really extensive, aren't they? I mean, they include publishers on, I think, all the continents, certainly big publishers like the New York Times, The Guardian, Fairfax in Australia is a fledgling partner as well. So what have you learned so far about audience engagement with AMP'd content? And where are you seeing real evidence of impact?
So a couple of things. Yes, it's been a, I think it's been a fascinating year. This did start out as an idea that, you know, I and others surfaced for discussion, indeed, at Newsgeist in Helsinki on May 15th. Of last year, and the term I put up on the board for the discussion was the portable content unit. You know, it was how do we create an architecture for content to be able to be where the users want to be, and in a sense, that's what we've done by eliminating the friction. Yes, it involves at this point now thousands of publishers are involved, and it's the most active open source project we've ever managed. There are 7,000 developers involved, obviously tens of thousands of publishers involved. We've created working groups for each of the four segments of AMP functionality: the format itself, analytics, paywalls, ads, which by the way is open to anyone's participation. If a company wants to participate in the working groups, we invite them. We want them there. That's how we set priorities. That's how we determine the roadmap for what we do next. So what are we seeing in terms of metrics? Now, first of all, this is just months since it's been out in the wild, we now have indexed at Google over 110 million AMP documents from over 500,000 domains around the world. We are seeing on a daily basis 500,000 AMP files being produced from over 10,000 domains around the world. So that certainly speaks for the fact that it is resonating with the community, and I'm delighted to see that. But I'm also, you know, very cautious in saying no mission has yet been accomplished. We have a lot of work to do. In terms of engagement, you know, it's a little bit early to have a whole lot of numbers in terms of how does consumption go up. But as I've often said, yes, I've been working in this business for, my first online product was in 1979 using broadcast teletext. And someone asked me back then, you know, is what's the ideal access time for a piece of content? And my answer then was the same as my answer now, instant. Because anything less than instant, you just see a degradation in engagement, right? Our research has told us that 40% of users will abandon a page if it takes longer than 33 seconds to load. So it gives you a sense. We all now, we hover on links before we click on them because we're saying, is it worth it clicking on that link? What does that do to our ability and inclination to browse and discover? It breaks it. It diminishes it entirely. So we know that consumption increases dramatically, and it will vary depending on the surface you're in.
Can you give us a breakdown of that? When you say increases dramatically, do you have any figures that you can?
It depends on the surface. For instance, in Google search, we don't have enough metrics yet to start releasing specific numbers, but if you just sort of think through the model, you know, I recently was, the FBI Apple thing was a big story, and so I just did a quick search for FBI Apple because I was interested, and came back, and there was a carousel of 8 articles. I read 5 of them. I can assure you, 6 months ago, at best I'd have read 1. Maybe I'd have bounced back and read another. But it was so easy for me to consume them and flip over to the next and consume it that I read 5. Now, I don't want to make a mathematical projection from that, but it just stands to reason that it will compel people to consume more. As I say, we can't increase the amount of time in the day, but we can be smarter at helping people take best advantage of the time they do have. Now, there is another element where we do have some very interesting data, which is about ads, and it's early data, but frankly, it was incredibly encouraging. Because one of the things when we moved forward with the project, frankly, we felt that at least in the early stages, there might very well be a dip in revenue, simply because there's so much transformation. We're not supporting all the ad behaviors for understandable reasons. So in some of those are high CPM ads. So clearly there was the opportunity for at least a short-term degradation. We don't seem to be seeing much of that. Obviously, different publishers have different experiences, but the anecdotal evidence I'm collecting there is we don't seem to be seeing that dip. Most specifically, from what we see from our data on the ad side of our business, I can tell you 3 interesting statistics. One is that we're seeing a 10 to 30% increase in viewability. Part of this stands to reason because the way the architecture is built is to, I call it a just-in-time architecture. Don't load any data until it's necessary. Load only the data you need, and don't render anything until the user is ready to see it. So that goes with ads. Let's make sure they're there when the user is ready to see it, and not any sooner than that. But great to see an increase in viewability. We've seen 100 to 150% increase in click-throughs on ads. That's a great number. And our best sense of that at this stage is largely because it's a cleaner experience. Now, again, with AMP, there are no rules. It's a format. If you want to build an AMP page with 40 ads on it, you can do it, right? But that's the whole idea. This is not no one's setting the rules for how AMP can be used. But the fact is, the way it works, the way it's operating, the way people are using it, it is more respectful. And so people are actually clicking on the ads. And we're seeing a 10 to 30% increase in effective CPMs. And again, this is what makes me feel very good about that data is that these are very early days,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
We're not supporting all the ad behaviors. And certainly the exchanges aren't reflecting the value of AMP in pricing. Yet, so we're not even close to where we want to be. I think the potential going forward is very significant, and I want to give folks just a sense of the few of the things that we're working on in the very short term. And again, these are collective decisions of folks involved with the project. One is, you know, there was a big interest in bringing back an adhesion unit. And adhesion units are fine if they're, you know, if they're appropriately produced and fit in the page properly and don't disrupt other things. So we'll create a nice, elegant, the project will create a nice, elegant adhesion unit. We're creating another unit called the Magic Carpet, which is an ad unit that elongates as you scroll the page. You could think of it as a non-invasive interstitial. Okay. You can move fast by it if you want, but it's there and it does command your attention. And then the other two things I think have even more potential, and that is the use of AMP for the ads themselves. Right, so that the ads themselves can load fast and seamlessly in the experience. And secondly is the use of AMP for ads landing pages. Right, what happens when you click on that ad? That's as hugely important as the ad itself. Sure. And everyone who knows the space knows that to the extent there's friction, fulfillment goes down, profitability goes down. So to the extent that click on that ad can resolve instantly, and in many cases in place, say, you know, with the form or the order mechanism in place seamlessly, then that will yield, I think, significantly uptick in profitability on the ads themselves. So, I mean, those are just four of the things that we're working on, I think, that show a particular promise in how we can move forward with this.
Okay, let's have a look at something that's launched just this week, which is AMP being ramped up, if you like, with a carousel that's been launched, I think, only in the US at this stage, is that right? That essentially loads 14 AMP-based articles. So tell us how that's going to work and a bit about how publishers outside of the US might be able to get access to it.
So, first of all, yes, as you know, on February 25th, I think it was, we launched AMP on Google Search, but only on the mobile web and only with the carousel. We're now very aggressively working on rolling it out across all the canvases we possibly can. So not just the carousels, but all of the results in mobile search. The same for the Google Search app and the iOS search app. Google News, yes, we launched Google News with AMP yesterday in the United States. We will roll it quickly out to other countries over the next weeks, hopefully not much longer than weeks. Because it's obviously it's just great benefit to get it out there. And yes, with Google News, we have a carousel at the top that has, in a sense, that has the top stories of the moment. And then the page continues with all of the regular sections. And in those sections, if the articles are AMP, we show the lightning bolt icon. That's the icon for the open source project. You know, our intent there was a few things. One is we know that our users appreciate the performance, and in our beta test, it was the change was quite significant. So we're trying to service the users' needs by giving them a fast-acting experience. Those top stories basically come from all of the standard sections. No question, we're putting a spotlight on AMP because, as I said, I think it's such a crucial initiative that we do so, and it's a very powerful experience for our users.
So just explain to me, how do you get selected to be one of the top 14 articles that are displayed in that Google News search carousel of AMP articles?
So, we haven't changed our ranking principles, okay. And this is true of search as well, right? That's very important to us. Obviously, speed, as I said, is always been a characteristic. So with that headline carousel, basically what we look at is how are the articles ranking in all of the different sections? Because we select them from, you'll see there are top stories from, say, you know, the U.S. national section, international, all the way down to sports. So we look at the ranking within those sections and basically pick out the highest ranking AMP article. If it's got to be high up there. We don't dig down way deep because obviously quality matters. There isn't always 15 there. We try to have 15. We may even elongate it to 20 depending on how we see users interact with it. But the objective is Let's make our users happy. Let's give them the ability to consume more than they have before, which is to the benefit of all of us.
So it is still about scale, though, right? So it's the most popular articles that happen to also be apt that will make it to that carousel.
No, I wouldn't say it's about scale. It's popularity is, popularity isn't a factor. Not in a direct sense. As I said, there are a lot of signals. Now, one thing that we've always looked at in our ranking is how do people, and it's all again machine driven. What domains, what sites, in a sense, have more respect, like PageRank, in effect, yeah. Right? Have built more respect over time. That's not necessarily based on scale. And frankly, you've always been able to look at Google News and Google Search, and in many cases, you might find an article from ProPublica or Salon or Slate or small sites from any country around the world. And we want to keep it that way, and we will keep it that way. At the moment, it might be the case, but I say only might. This is not based on math. Is it more likely today that larger news organizations are adopting AMP more quickly than smaller? That may very well be a factor in place, but that's also why we immediately reached out with the project to WordPress. WordPress now automatically amps everything on WordPress. Clearly, there are torso publishers in between who are using different kinds of CMSs. We had someone build the modules for Drupal so that support would be there as well. Clearly, it's in all of our interest to drive adoption as broadly as we can. And in truth, someone asked me, like, is this biased towards large publishers? Yeah. And I would say explicitly not, because if you start off at that core point about making sure the web is healthy, one of my big concerns about the potential rise of proprietary platforms is on proprietary platforms is usually where the bigger players get more attention, right? Because it's the smaller players who don't have the savvy or the business development people or whatnot to go work the different platforms.
Statisticians or the analysts.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And that to me is not acceptable. That's the tremendous thing about this ecosystem, and we think about the future of news, is that so many people can participate, mm-hmm. right? One of the reasons why I've always been so optimistic is that so many voices can come into play. We see small sites like Climate Change News in the United States who won a Pulitzer 5 years ago. That's a wonderful thing. That's what we want to see happen. Okay. And so it's very, very much a part of our philosophy in doing this.
So what about the question of monetization? Obviously, it's early days. You just launched in February. But this is the issue that publishers and editors are bringing up regularly already. We think it's promising. We're not entirely sure whether it's able to be monetized. So what do you do? You've talked about advertising, but what about paywalled content and subscriber content? How will AMP work within those more nuanced business models?
Yeah, and both are hugely important. I frankly get annoyed when someone says that one should be able to build a site and survive on advertising alone. That's not necessarily the case, and particularly if you have a smaller scale, as you know, and particularly if you're doing high quality journalism that takes a significant expense. Clearly, subscriptions have to be part of the equation. Various business models have to be part of the equation, but paywalls are a significant one. One of my favorite examples today in this regard. Which addresses two points is a fascinating website out of Paris founded by Edwy Plenel, the former editor-in-chief of Le Monde, called Mediapart.
Yeah.
And it's focused solely on investigative reporting.
It's a great website.
Great website. They do tremendous work. It is a hard paywall site. They have something in excess of 300,000 subscribers paying €10 a month, right? And they've got 35 journalists. That's a tremendous example, I think, of what can happen. It, particularly if one has focus. Because I think the one thing, when we talk about paywalls, we have to remember that marketplace economics, all the rules still apply, right? I will pay for what I value. I will pay for uniqueness. And in a sense, one of the challenges in the news ecosystem, as I've sometimes mentioned, is in many cases there's simply too much of it. There is an overabundance of it. You could see that in Google News every day because you'll see the top story about Donald Trump has 5,000 articles there, right? So clearly everyone's jumping on the same story.
It's all about the toupee.
That's okay, but if you're trying to establish a unique proposition in the eyes of people who you expect to pay, then you probably have to have something that's special and unique, either in the kind of content coverage you provide or the attitude and approach and perspective that you take to it. So all those rules apply. But to your point, there too about AMP, right from the beginning we said when we cannot look at paywalls as a secondary step. You know, so from the first day, paywalls, we had paywall support, client-side paywall support, which is what most paywalls use. Within the next month and a half to 2 months, we'll have client-side paywall support. But we also want to look at it, and again, there's a working group on this as well, because we're not the experts in paywalls. There's a working group there as well, is how can we continue to refine the discovery and fulfillment flows to shorten the process, right? I mean, I've seen some paywall processes out there that take 20 steps.
I've given up trying to subscribe myself to various publications.
And we wonder why, abandonment rates might be high.
Yeah.
So you got to have an appropriate value proposition, and you have to have a subscription process that people can get through quickly.
So have you got any examples of media publishers, of news publishers who are working closely with you? I think the Wall Street Journal is involved in...
Well, again, it's whoever wants to come to us. I mean, sometimes people use the word partner. I mean, frankly, the word partner doesn't apply to AMP, right? And that was really a key point. The wonderful thing about the web is it's deal-less. And that's true about AMP as well. There are no partners. There are participants.
Okay. So any participants
yes,
you want to highlight?
Yes, on the paywall side, and again, there's probably a list longer than I can remember. Well, without question, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Financial Times, and several others, is just to bring knowledge to the table such that we can all collectively work to figure out what to build next. And it's not all built by us, by the way. As I said, 3,000 code submissions, a lot. We've probably written the bulk of the code, but I'd like to think over time more and more of the code is coming from others.
It's really collaborative. Let's go to some audience questions now. I've got other questions I could ask, but I'd really rather hear from you. And I noticed that over the past 24 hours, not many people are putting up their hands. So here's the encouragement. Here's your chance to ask Richard Gingras directly, either about the AMP project or any of the news initiatives. And Dean Roper from Wanifra has a question, I see.
Yes, I'd just like to turn for 1 minute to the DNI initiative and just if you could open that up in terms of what you have learned from some of the projects already or how that's going. And I think we'll have some more questions on that, hopefully.
Yes, I'm both pleased and proud of what we've done with the DNI. And frankly, the important thing is that I think Google has learned a lot by it. You know, it goes both ways, and that to me is the most important dynamic. It's opened a lot of eyes at Google. Right. I mean, the interesting thing, as I said, we may have common objectives, but we come at the ecosystem from very different perspectives. We build different services. We're an engineering company. We're not a media company. You know, I have lots of folks who are great with code and sorry-assed with words, and publishers is kind of the reverse. I love talking to journalists far more than I like talking to engineers, but they write brilliant code. So. I could get in trouble for that.
It's out there now, Richard.
It's out there now. I'll have to live by it. That's okay. In any case, going back to the question. So it's really been useful and eye-opening for Google. And we went into this. There are a lot of first-time things here. This is the first time Google is ever engaged in this kind of collaborative product development process. And again, it's been hugely valuable to us. So it goes both ways. So you know whether it's I think the AMP project is in many regards the best example because it so involves everyone in coming together with it. You know, the YouTube embedded player project, I think, has tremendous potential and value for advertisers. The Trust Project as another journalism community initiative to rethink what kinds of signals journalists can provide their audiences and algorithms to make sure credible content rises to the surface. I'm obviously looking forward to see what kinds of efforts come out of the innovation projects, right? We just finished the first round of funding. So I think it's been very, very positive. It's something that we clearly look to continue. And in a sense, it's caused us to, you know, D&I is in Europe, but the truth is it's we're doing these things. I mean, we've taken this engagement approach to a global perspective. My last year, I've probably spent more time in airplanes than out of airplanes, trying to, bring these things together. But it's been worthwhile, and hopefully we'll continue to see it bear fruit, whether it's as the AMP project evolves or, you know, what's the next project we do after the YouTube embedded player. You know, and there are obviously a lot more conversations to have.
Sure. My name is Justin Evans from IBT Media. We publish Newsweek and International Business Times. Om Malik, the founder of GigaOm, was recently quoted as saying that if he was in the news business today, he wouldn't launch a website. He'd launch straight onto a distributed platform, maybe even Facebook. I'd like to know what Richard's view is if he was going to launch a web news business today.
The question was that Om Malik said recently that if he were to launch a news site today, he would launch it only on distributed platforms and he wouldn't do a website. Interestingly, that's frankly what AMP is in effect designed to do, is because given the lack of friction, you can actually do both at the same time. You can have a highly responsive website and also have the content available at speed for distribution platforms as well. I think as you might have heard, the AMP project is about instant everywhere. And that means not just on platforms who decide to support AMP and build it into their experiences like Twitter and like Pinterest, but you can share an article done in AMP into Facebook and it will also resolve significantly quickly than a standard URL. And clearly, we would love to see Facebook move towards AMP, and maybe they will, Apple News as well. So I think, philosophically, Om is correct in saying you want to build content that is able to get to users wherever they are. But that, frankly, is the beauty of the AMP architecture, is that you can do that and have an appropriate destination site at the same time.
You still obviously have to bring your audience to your site, though. I mean, that's
you
got to
exactly, but that's the that's a key difference. And if I look at Facebook Instant Articles, at least today, we'll see how they change. You can't include links to you can't include onward journeys to your site.
You're trapped.
They're trapped. Well, frankly, what are these from a publisher's perspective? What has search and social always been about? It's not just about that incidental look at a specific article. As I've always said, your articles are the entry point for new users to your branded experience. It's not about the home page, it's about the article page. People don't come through the front door, they come through the bathroom window. And so you really need to take full advantage of that. The fact that I can't do onward journeys in instant articles basically says I can't build an engaged relationship with the user, much less get them to subscribe if I need subscription revenue. And that clearly is not the philosophy behind the AMP project. In many regards, I personally, as I said, I'm very optimistic and it's been fabulous to see the kind of innovation we're seeing. I truly think we're seeing a renaissance in the evolution of media, in the evolution of journalism, and I think that's a fabulous thing. But I think we also need to be aware that there are many risks to the web. The risks that we've talked about today are the risks of poor performance and the risk of an ad system going awry. But there are others as well, and I think we should all be aware of them. And some of you may not agree with me on this, and that's fine. But I want to make this point nonetheless. As you know, in Spain several years ago, there was an ancillary copyright law was passed. And as a result, we shut down Google News. Also, a number of many other aggregators in Spain shut down. Many small websites shut down because they were fearful about what the link tax meant. Here's what we've learned in that year, by the way, since we shut it down. In that year in Spain, internet traffic went up, as you would expect it to be. News traffic went down. And all the news publishers suffered. And not surprisingly, the small publishers suffered more than the large publishers. So these are damaging and, I think, unnecessary, particularly at this point in time, public policy approaches to the web. They're very dangerous. And I think we're now seeing, by the way, the resurfacing of an ancillary copyright effort in Brussels, now sort of rebranded as neighboring rights.
This is that in the local Brussels jurisdiction?
No, this is the European Commission.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think we all have to be aware of that, particularly, obviously, if you're a European-based publisher. Because, frankly, the objective of those efforts, in a sense, is to break the web, because that's what happens. If you break the link infrastructure of the web, everything we've talked about here, about using the web to build audiences and content distribution and so forth, gets dramatically weakened. And as I said earlier, you know, the objective of any publisher, whether you're big or small, whether you've got an existing product or a new one, is to use this environment to find new audiences, particularly challenging with a new product where you're starting from zero. Right? Do we want to make that harder? Do we want to challenge the degree of investment that goes into innovation because that's harder and more expensive? So I think we have to be very careful and very aware of some of these public policy considerations, which, frankly, are typically and largely driven by embedded institutions like looking to protect old businesses. And while I understand that from an emotional perspective, I think it is very short-sighted from a perspective of both the health and future of the web as well as the health and future of those businesses. Because even if you're a big publisher with big brands today, as we know, this is a different media marketplace with different audiences. And if you look at the younger generations, they're not using those traditional products as heavily as older audiences, which means that even those larger institutions need to develop new products that can succeed in that environment, which brings us back to that point. How do we lower the need for investment? How do we increase the opportunity for innovation? How do we take and enrich the web and make it a vital place where people can discover new sources of content? So I have to make that message to everyone here, because if we're not aware of that, you should be. If you're not active in addressing those challenges, you should be. It matters to all of us. Because I fear these things tend to, you know, you see something happen in one part of the world, and before you know it, it's happening somewhere else.
Yeah, there's flow-on effects, for example, with the right to be forgotten. We're seeing that. Are you challenging in that? Are you defending that action that's happening?
Oh, absolutely. I spend more time in Brussels than I would have ever thought. A lovely city, by the way. You know, in fact, I was at the European Commission building on the day of the subway bombings, which was an interesting experience. But we're going to obviously do everything from our perspective. But we're one company, and as I often say about the AMP project, you know, the AMP project will succeed based on the leadership of many, not the leadership of one. Right, and frankly, I think the reason why it has managed to get as far as it has in this short, less than 1 year time is because of that, because the leadership of many. And the same thing is true when it comes to these legislative challenges. It's got to be the leadership and the participation of many, not a singular voice. If anyone thinks that those legislative efforts are solely about Google News, whether rightfully or wrongly, and obviously I believe wrongly, given how much traffic we send publishers and how valuable that traffic is, it's not. Right? It's about the nature of the web, it's about the fabric of the web, it's about the nature of the link itself.
Julie?
So you're looking for collaboration, presumably, on that front?
Absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, there is one with his hand up. Sorry, I was blinded by lights.
That's all right. Hi. DNI obviously has some PR value as well as a pathway towards innovation in the business. The ancillary copyright law that you're talking about and these new voices in Austria and Germany. All right, we'll do it this way. In Austria and Germany, notably here and across the border, are quite loud these days. Other than speaking about it in front of audiences like here, are there talks, direct talks at a table happening where Google and either publishing associations or publishers are discussing this? Or is it only happening in Brussels or in larger forums like this?
I and my colleagues at Google are having conversations with everyone we possibly can. And yes, with publisher associations. You know, because I think a lot of this, I think one of the values of D&I, no question there's some PR value, but one of the values of D&I, I think, again, is that collaborative effort and that opportunity to bring everyone to the same level of understanding of how the ecosystem works, right? I mean, the one thing that's clear to me, and this is on Google, is that I don't think we've, in our history, been proactive enough at telling our story. We assume people understand, and they don't. Even the basics of how our business works. Right, I was working on the effort against ancillary copyright in Spain, and I learned in the week before the law passed that the executives of some of the biggest publishers in Spain did not realize that Google News had no advertising. Right, did not realize that articles didn't surface in Google News; they surfaced on the websites with their full business models intact. You know, so again, that's in a sense on us to continue the effort to make sure folks understand how the ecosystem works. Interestingly, if you talk to the digital people in any of these publishing organizations across Europe, what do they tell us? They tell us, no, ancillary copyright, we understand how the ecosystem works. That makes no sense. That's going to hurt us. But clearly, we have to continue to have that dialogue and get us to a point where sound political decisions can be made. And we'll do our best to do that, and hopefully others here will help participate as well.
We've got, I was about to say 5 minutes left, and now I'm being told we have 1 minute left. Richard, I wanted to talk about issues around trust and credibility, but we might have to leave that for another time when it comes to news content. But if I can get you to cast your mind forward a couple of years, even though we are now in what some publishers acknowledge is a state of permanent beta when it comes to reinventing journalism or news production and distribution. Looking forward, what do you think, if we were sitting here in 2018, we'd be talking about as the key issues confronting the news publishing business, the key trends and concerns?
Well, I hope we're sharing more learnings about successes with innovation and not just talking about the need for innovation. And we're seeing some of that today. But I think, you know, the fact is, it takes a surprising amount of time, I think, for companies to sort of understand a new marketplace. In fact, you know, and I speak very specifically from my experience in the United States. I think, you know, like newspapers in the United States spent the first 15 years of the internet, if not longer, thinking of the internet as simply an extension of distribution of the products that they built in the world of print. And the one thing I think that we know, if you study media history, is a media product is born of its ecosystem, born of its marketplace, born of its distribution environment. You know, if you look at the history of the modern American newspaper was actually the result of the disruptive effects of television in 1947 to 1950, because it took and had a huge impact on the newspaper market. Dozens, hundreds of newspapers, thousands of newspapers shut down. You had 24 newspapers in New York. You had 8 newspapers in San Francisco. You went down to 1, and then they were left in a very powerful position and used that appropriately to build the modern American newspaper, which was a great product and an extremely profitable one. But if you look at this environment here, I learned this when I was running Salon, but that gardening site in the Dallas Morning News that generated a lot of revenue in its time and place on the web is competing with 25 gardening websites that are focused just on that, with a value proposition for advertisers that's much more direct, right? And so it's simply recognizing that in this market, you have to develop products that are appropriate to this competitive environment. Where are the opportunities in the information economy that are appropriate to the audiences and the behaviors they expect in products? So I think, frankly, we're still at the early stages of the creative evolution evolution of media products in the first place. I hope we're talking in 5 years much more about new media forms. You know, I've been a strong evangelist of opportunities in data journalism, not just to do data analysis, to do articles with interesting infographics in them, but to build persistent knowledge utilities that provide ongoing value to societies and can have business models attached. I think that's a hugely important thing, particularly in a world where people now are consuming information in different ways and reaching conclusions about what they understand about their worlds in different ways. And it's absolutely terrifying. And when I see what's happening, particularly in the political landscape, where we're so inclined to drive people by their fear of the other, we have to bring data-driven knowledge into the equation. And I think knowledge utilities is a way to get there, just one. But that's the kind of creative focus I would like to see, is that every dimension of the media model, what's the evolution of the media forms, what's the evolution of the narrative style, what's the evolution of different business models, what new media forms like knowledge utilities should we create? I think knowledge utilities should be a first-order media object. You know, if I do a search for crime rate on Google, it should both see where I live and come back and say, here's the New York Times knowledge utility, by the way, showing you what the murder rates are in New York and its surrounding areas. I think that would be an interesting thing when you live in a world where people see, bizarre and unfortunate violent circumstances happen in various parts of the world and equate it to their local societies. That's so hugely damaging. We can do better, and I think it benefits not only society, it benefits news products, and I think it's an opportunity, frankly, for new models and including new revenue. ProPublica, for instance, I mentented dialysis. They have a knowledge utility about dialysis treatment centers.
They do, and
that
they
continue to maintain, and they make money with it.
Yeah.
In that case, because they license the results of their analysis to insurance companies. Fair game. It's a business model. It supports the creation of knowledge. It helps society.
Okay, Richard Gingras, that was an optimistic and exciting note on which to end this fireside chat. It's been a pleasure. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
That was Google's head of news, Richard Gingras, talking to me in the rarefied environs of the Palais Liechtenstein in Vienna during Digital Media Europe. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at JExplainer, find us on Facebook and Audio Boom, and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. I'm Julie Pizzetti in Sydney. Speak to you again soon with my Singapore-based co-host Asha Phillips on the Journalism Explainer.